Hello and welcome to Launch. We're broadcasting live from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm your host, Ron Reardon. I'm joined in the studio by our producer, Lee Cantor. Good morning, Lee. How are you doing today?
I am doing great. Summer's in full swing. Got a lot of activity going on.
It's getting hot, let me tell you. It's time for inside activity, not outside. That's for certain. Well, Lee, on Launch, we feature inventors, entrepreneurs, related industries, providing our listeners with the opportunity to learn from the successes and failures of launching an idea and the journey that follows. This morning, we'll be featuring Mary Elroy of Gameberg LLC. But before we get started, Lee, could you thank today's sponsor?
Sure. Our sponsor today is Patents and More. Patents and More, protecting your innovation and connecting you to the resources you need for success.
Okay. Well, Mary Elroy has been in the toy business since 1990. She's an inventor of toys and games herself, as well as being an agent for toy and game inventors. Her games have won multiple awards, and she's one of these rare people that she's a games on demand contract inventor. Okay. And she serves on the board of the Yankee Invention Expo, which is an international forum for inventors. She's a president emeritus of the Inventors Association of Connecticut, which is one of the oldest and largest inventor organizations in the country. And she served on the board of Women in Toys. Mary, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So how did you get started in the game industry?
Well, I had a corporate job for a while. I went through the whole MBA corporate background routine, and I was working for a company that made me product manager of a product that you couldn't see or feel. You probably know it as call waiting, call forwarding, some of the telephone company product.
I know it very well. I worked in that industry.
Oh, you did? So you know what they are.
I didn't have
an ad budget, but I did have a computer budget. So I developed a game that would be on a point-of-purchase display in telephone stores where people could touch the screen and interact with the screen to find out what services they needed and how they worked. And I found that I absolutely loved gaming.
That's really cool because, I retired from Bell South after 32 years, and one of my tours of duty was being the product manager for call waiting and three-way calling.
No way.
Yeah. It's deja vu all over again. That's pretty incredible.
Small
wow.
World.
Yeah.
Well, you understand the challenge of trying to sell a product that you couldn't touch, feel, and see.
I know. And
and the other challenge back then was not every telephone area could get the services as the equipment was being rolled out. So we had to screen out those who could not. And the part of the gameplay was to find out what your exchange was, and if you could get it, then it would sell it to you or give you a decision tree. And if you couldn't get it, it would give you a nice hello, have a nice day message.
Yeah,
but it was all about gaming.
Yeah,
I fell in love with it.
Yeah, we always say there's two kinds of people out there, and this applied to call waiting because some people loved call waiting and some other people absolutely hated call waiting.
Well, I think if you're the caller and trying to reach somebody, you love call waiting.
Yeah, but I think it was kind of a demographic thing. Some of the older folks just did not like having this beep coming in while they were on one conversation, and they thought it was rude to put one person on hold to hear what the other person was, you know. But
now we're all used to it.
It's just like breathing now. But what type of games do you specialize in?
Well, I do the kind – when you think – of gaming, I think now you think of video games. And although I love them, I don't do them. I do board games, card games, mechanical games, the kind of games you see on the shelf at a toy store, at a traditional toy store.
Okay. I mean, do any of your games make it into places like Starbucks or anything like that?
Well, I know Cranium started there, and I do Cranium-type games for sure.
Oh.
Yeah, Starbucks, that was a brilliant strategy on Cranium's part, too, to decide to go into to Starbucks. But I do the types of games go into Starbucks, but most of my games have gone into Starbucks.
Okay. So what's selling and not selling nowadays?
Well, the board games enjoyed a great resurgence during the recession because people couldn't afford to go out. And they found they could have a great time sitting around the table and having people over and having game night. So board games came kind of roaring out. They were declining a bit, and they came roaring back. And Hasbro did a very successful promotion several years ago called Family Game Night. And it really helped all the game companies, because people started realizing it's a whole lot of fun to sit around with your family and friends and play a game. So games are doing well. Social interaction games, which are games that allow you to get to know other people. Games like, well, the old Scruples. Buffalo Games has a product called Imagine If, where you try to figure out how someone will think, and you get to know other people, and it's all about laughing and having fun. And those games are in high demand.
That's cool. I know there are certain games that really frustrate me, because if it's a trivia game that has to do with TV, I don't watch a lot of TV, and so, you know, I just don't know the answers to those questions.
Right.
Right. Well, it's true. Knowledge games aren't as popular as getting-to-know-you games.
Oh, okay.
Games about other people and your friends and, you know, what would you do in this situation type games. Those are the game companies are really looking for those types of games. Men are from Mars, women are from Venus. There's quite a few out now, but there's always room for more.
Yeah. Can you take our listener through, like, the path? Like, say you have an idea for one of those games. What's the process to go from that idea to actually, I guess, building a prototype of some kind and then actually getting it made?
Well, one thing that inventors don't realize is the lead time that you need. People came to me during the presidential primary with a game, who's going to win, Hillary or Obama? And it was right during the primary, and what they didn't realize was that it was going to take 18 months to 2 years to get from concept to on the shelf. So one thing you need to think about is, if your game is topical, it can't be so topical that it has to come out now. You need to understand it, so there's a little bit of time. Building a prototype isn't all that hard in the board game and card game business. If you're going to show it to an agent, you can really work with a fairly neat sketch on a board and cards drawn on a sheet of paper. People often send me digital files of cards laid out on a board and a very neat drawing with magic marker and hopefully computer at least typeface on the board. You don't even need to mount the board. In fact, it's easier if you don't, because it's easier to fold if you don't. Business card templates are great to use to make playing cards. Playing cards can be made out of cardstock. So in terms of the logistics of prototypes, for a board game, it's not all that complicated. But it just has to be neat and comprehensible, and you need to have enough questions, challenges, to just make it possible to understand how the game is played. I have people who come to me with 1,000 cards. You know, in order to show your idea, you really only need about 20 just to get the idea across. There's several routes you could go. You could, and I'm talking about licensing versus manufacturing your own game. Licensing is what I do, which means selling your idea and getting a royalty. If you show your concept to an agent, as I said, it doesn't have to be that polished, because you're just trying to show the agent what your idea is. If you decide to approach game companies directly, then your prototype needs to be a lot more professional looking. Now, I'm mentioning the word agent, and you may get to that, but some companies require you to have somebody to represent you. Others do not. You can actually approach some companies yourself.
Yeah, and that's really unusual, because in your particular area, because, you know, in the past, a lot of industries just said, we don't want to talk to individual inventors. And I think the toy and game industry has always been a little bit different.
Well, the toy and game industry is actually a lot easier entry for inventors than other ones. As an inventor, I love all things invention. That is hardware, housewares, you know, cooking products. I love invention. And most companies outside of toys, you cannot approach them without a patent. You can't get to Black & Decker without a patent. You can't get to certain companies without a patent. But the toy industry, you can. That doesn't mean you should, but you can, which makes it more easy entry for beginner inventors and individual inventors, because the toy industry is so idea-centric that they welcome ideas. Now, again, this is not to say you shouldn't get a patent, but you don't need one, and you can work with a provisional patent or other forms of protection.
Okay, so
which the companies sometimes provide in their submission agreements.
Okay, and what is the industry looking for nowadays?
Oh boy, I can recite the standard litany, because we do hear some of the same things year after year, and it does change. But in the traditional game industry, they are looking for, as I mentioned before, social interaction. That is, games where people can get to know one another. The traditional toy industry is not that interested in heavy-duty strategy games. Those games do have a niche market, but not in the traditional toy industry. Light strategy, such as the game Block Us, is of interest, but that is just starting to pick up. They like bigger companies like Hasbro and Mattel are looking to leverage their brands. That means if you can invent another version of Scrabble that plays somewhat like Scrabble but has some sort of gimmick that makes it different, but it still looks enough like Scrabble, they could be interested in. So looking at current brands, figuring out how to make another version. Uno is a great example of that. The game Uno started out as a card game that plays similarly to Crazy Eights. And there's probably three or four versions now, Uno Rummio, Uno Stacko. So companies like to see their brands that they work so hard to establish being used again, being used again for products that somewhat resemble but don't quite resemble the original.
Yeah, I enjoyed playing both, Uno and, Hearts and Spades and Crazy Eights. I enjoyed all of those games.
But oh, yeah, card games are also in demand because there's not a huge risk in setting up a factory to tool a game. You're printing cards. That's not as complicated as molding plastic.
Yeah, years ago I read an article about Rubik's Cube that all the toy companies in the United States originally turned it down because they said it violated all the rules of a successful game. And it wasn't until one of the owners missed his flight over in Europe and went into a coffee shop and saw everybody using Rubik's Cube that he said, I don't care if it does violate those rules, it's selling.
I know, isn't that something?
Yeah. So
and I do have, I do tell new inventors, you want to look at companies and see what they're already making and make something that fits in with what they're already making in terms of materials and everything else. But Rubik's Cube is one of those great examples where, well, every now and then somebody takes a right turn or a left turn.
Yeah, that's true. And so how do you do market research on whether or not a game is going to be has a potential to be successful?
Well, I always tell people, too, you test your game. And testing is kind of tricky because there's a concept called the Hawthorne effect, which is where when people are singled out, they like something no matter what you show them.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with
so
the Hawthorne effect.
So you have to sort of overcome that. And what I used to do when I tested games, and that means sitting down and playing a game with people, is tell them that somebody was paying me to test the game, that I hadn't invented it, so that they didn't try to please me as much.
Okay.
But people still somehow, you have to overcome that, gee, this is new and different, I think I like it. And play the game, give them the directions without explaining the game, and see if they can follow the directions. Try not to coach them. Just watch. See if they get stuck in a logical loop. Or see if one player just gets so far ahead of everybody else, it's not fun. Those kinds of things you don't want in a game. Play it again and again and again, and tweak the rules and the materials until those kinds of things don't happen. And if you hear the magic words, can we play again, you have a hit.
Oh, okay.
Or you at least have a shot at having a hit.
That's right. Well, how long does this testing process last? I mean, can that be done in one day, or is it over a period of time?
It sometimes can be done, and I've actually done this with partners over Skype phone calls, where you have a video phone call, and you look at one another, and you run through it. There's certain things. I had an inventor come to me about a year ago from Atlanta, I believe, who had a game. We kind of tweaked it, worked on it. He called me back. He improved it, and the moment he described it, I said, this is a great game, and it is right now being held under evaluation by several different companies. So, you know, sometimes it's an instinct. After you've done it for a while, you know. But, you know, you do. You got to play and play. And then another way of doing research is one of my favorite things to tell game inventors is to go to the store and go to Walmart and go to the cool little sciencey toy stores and mom and pops and look on the shelf and pick up the box, read the back of the box, see how the game plays, kind of look and see what there are a lot of. And if you're, you know, if you're looking for children's games, you'll see a lot of molded plastic and games with characters, animals, things like that, that have surprise payoffs. You'll start to understand the industry. That's probably the best way to understand the industry of any kind of research you can do. And that helps you with developing your game. Oh, I see. This guy's got this kind of way of randomizing. That may make more sense with my game than a dice. You know, that kind of thing, to see what others are doing. And so a combination of playing your game, testing it, tweaking it, and seeing what others are doing, and websites, game company websites, but going to the store is a better way.
Now, what's it look like for a person who invents a game? Like, what's a home run? How much money do you think that they can make? Do they become millionaires, or is this something where they can make a living?
It's widely divergent. Of course, the Scrabble estate is, I'm not even sure if they're still earning royalties, to be honest with you, but people who have classic games that have been on the market for many, many, many years, you know, obviously do make a lot of money. The inventor of the Super Soaker Squirt Gun made a lot of money. You really have to have a hit to make a lot of money. But what I do is have lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of things out there. And some things make decent. Some things make a little bit, enough money for a night out. And they're all over the place. Some companies pay advances of $1,000. Some don't pay any. Some pay $20,000. And obviously the bigger companies pay more money. And the longevity of your product on the market determines how much money you make as well. I've had a game out on the market for 10 years, and that's been very, very nice. I don't like to discuss numbers, but, you know, yes, you can make a living out of it.
Okay. Mary, there's a book out there called The Toy and Game Handbook. I'm sure you're familiar with that book. Is that something that somebody that's getting into the...
I'm sorry. Can you speak up a little
bit? Yeah, there's a book called The Toy and Game Handbook.
Oh, Weingartner Levy?
Correct.
Yes.
Is that a book that somebody that wants to get into this kind of industry should read?
Absolutely. Ron Weingartner was the inventor relations guy at Hasbro, and I used to present to him. And Ron, to his credit, you know, Hasbro sees thousands and thousands of games a year, and he took the time to write me a letter back in the letter writing days to explain why he did not take this or that product on. And I learned from that. And he puts that knowledge into the book. And Richard Levy has written several books about invention. And he's invented and helped to broker some of the most successful toys on the market, like Furby and Triominoes. He's a powerhouse. So they are two of the top people in the business. The book's been out a little while. I haven't read it in a while. But, you know, I think the information is probably as up-to-date as it needs to be. Things change all the time.
Right.
So there may be some things that have changed since that was written, but I think it's a Bible for newbies.
Now, has the Internet changed things where a person could now create a website themselves and then kind of self-promote and distribute the game themselves online?
I think that's true. The side of the business where people manufacture their own games is something that scares me to death. there's an aisle at Toy Fair called the Game Aisle, and it's all of the new one-up inventors who have invented one game, and a lot of them are really cool. But what the problem is, when you are self-producing, it's a huge job. You are not only a producer, a manufacturer, but you're also, you know, in the electronics fund transfer business and the inventory business and the retail relations business. And in a lot of businesses that you probably didn't think about when you created your game. So, yes, you can, you know, produce your own website. But then again, that means you're producing your own game, which means you are overseeing manufacturing, design, quality control, inventory control. So there's so many other factors that go into you know, doing your own thing, that the website is just one part of the promotional package, and that has to be great. And then you have to drive traffic to it, which is in itself a science.
Well, back on, I was kind of intrigued when you said that you could use a business card template to actually make, you know, playing cards that you use in a game. What else is involved in putting together a prototype?
Well, the way I usually do it is, again, I use computer graphics as much as I can. And if I'm creating a board, you can do a small little tiny board on a graphics program and send it over to a place like Kinko's and have them print a board size. I would keep in mind that the board should, game companies don't like huge boards or complex boards. Use something like Trivial Pursuit as a template for your board size. All of the game companies are looking for what we call a device. And that's kind of an obscure concept because it means something new and different that makes the game stand out. The game companies have all seen roll the die, move the guy, pick a card, do something. You know, that's Monopoly. That was unique and novel in its day. And now, if a game company has those features, it needs something else. An example of a device, and this, I try to explain this one to new inventors, and I wish I could remember the name of this game, but there was a game that had a board that was about the size of a 33 RPM record, if you remember what that is.
Oh, yes.
And all around the outside edge, it had dates, 1920, 1921, all the way up to 2000. And the questions in the game regarded when things happened. So if you picked a card and say it said, when was the first moon landing, you might remember that it was 1969.
Right.
Or you might remember that it was somewhere around 1969, somewhere then. And the game had these little pieces that covered one date or two dates or three dates, or four dates, or five, you know, they were bigger and bigger pieces, shaped like arcs that covered the edge of the board around, you know, around the dates. And the less you knew for sure the dates, the bigger the piece you might take to cover the dates. And the bigger piece had less point value. So that's what we call a device. It's clever. You say, wow. You know, if you knew the date, 1969, you'd take the little piece, and that would be worth 10 points, and you'd cover the date. And it would be worth 10 points. If you didn't know for sure and you thought, well, late 60s, and covered four or five dates, it would be worth fewer points. That is a device. It's a clever, raise your eyebrows, wow, cool. That's a way to play the game, make an impression on the toy company, and be clever. And that's the obscure, difficult thing to do in the game invention process. If you have a device that flips a little mechanical device, flips something or grabs something, you don't have to necessarily. You could get a good sketch of it with a little bit of detail on how it works. You'd have to get to the point where you do describe how it works. You can't just say, well, it's a mechanical hand that grabs the dice. You have to say it's attached to a spring, to a lever. You know what I mean? You have to get an industrial designer to draw you a sketch, but you don't have to build it. Obviously, if you do build it, you make a better impression, but you don't have to. And I think that's important for inventors to know as well. And another technique I use for prototyping is really a product presentation technique, and it's called the fake video, where you take a video and make it look like it's doing what it does, but it doesn't really do it. In other words, if it has a sound chip that talks, you might have someone off stage doing the talking.
Okay.
So you literally can present. So I guess that's not really a prototype, because when you think about invention, you think about, you know, sort of proof of can this work? Will this fly? Will this roll? Will this chop? Will this? Whereas in a game, will it play is a little mushier of a concept, and can be proven with you know, acting and fakeness rather than the real thing, if you can get the point across.
Okay. Well, you know, most inventors are very paranoid, and, you know, when they present to a toy company, they're looking at patents and trademarks, copyrights. How do you protect your idea?
Well, interestingly, I have lost count, but somewhere like 36 games and toys, and I've patented one of them. Board games particularly, and this, a lot of inventors and I have conversations about this, it kind of can be hard to protect. Let's say you patent a board game. Board games usually consist of pawns, randomizer, meaning a dice or spinner, challenges, questions, etc. If you patent a specific process, randomizing, etc., somebody could say, well, I'll use the dice instead of spinners, and I'll change the path this way. And so board games are easy to work, have easy workaround patents. So people just say, okay, we're first to market, we'll just do it. You know, we'll get a brand name, and we'll get a famous company to buy the game and be the first ones out there, and nobody will be able to knock us off. And that's pretty much how you do it. However, I do have regrets in my life for not trademarking some of the better named products I've done. If the name is cool, if it makes the toy company raise their eyebrows and go, well, that's a pretty cool name, you better run to trademark it. It's not going to cost you very much.
Yeah, I know. With Rubik's Cube, you know, he waited more than a year to come to the United States after getting a patent in his home country in Europe, and he pretty much had to rely on the trademark Rubik's Cube and copyrights in order to protect it here.
Yeah, and what's interesting about the Rubik's Cube situation is there's a group of people to whom one must go. I've talked to them. If you have something that you want to brand with Rubik's, so I have been turned down by them.
Okay.
I had a spherical logic puzzle that was really cool, and they liked it, but they wouldn't part with their name, Rubik's. So you're right. The name has become very, very strong, and it's been applied to other concepts, as you'll see on the marketplace, that have certain components the same as Rubik's, i.e., spatial logic. But not every cubicle puzzle can go with that name. But the name is pretty important because the toy industry is all about fad and fashion, and so a name can be absolutely important. And a cool name is worth trademarking, and it's not that big of an investment to trademark the name. So, but also, many of the toy companies, especially the big ones, Hasbro, Mattel, etc., require you to sign their submission agreement and read it very carefully. It does protect you with them for a certain amount of time. In other words, I'll paraphrase, it'll say something like, you, for 2 years, if we do anything related to this idea, it's not, I wish I could say it more clearly, because they can pass on an idea and still do something with it, but they're fairly honorable. If you show them something and they sign your submission agreement, if something comes along that uses elements of your idea, but not all of it, they could pull you into that project in terms of getting royalties. But it does protect you. You need to read the submission agreement and see how long it protects you. 2 to 3 years is the usual amount of time. And so the submission agreements, they want ideas. Patents take a long time. Patents are expensive. If you require toy inventors to have patents for everything they do, you won't be getting a lot of ideas. So you have to have some kind of setup, and the submission agreement tends to work fairly well. Yes, patents are probably not a bad idea. Some people, in fact, I've had written into two contracts that I've done that the toy company will, if they decide to file a patent for this item, they will file it in your name and they will take it out of your royalties, which is a good deal because you've already made the sale before you had to file a patent. So there are a number of things you can do. What I do, and I'm not sure how well it works, is I write a little description of every item I show, a toy inventor relations guide, and I have them sign the little write-up. I don't have them say they won't steal it. I don't have them say I will have them say, I saw this on February 2nd, 2010. And, you know, I in my own little head, it's just a proof of somebody seeing something. And I do that. But the other thing, too, is if you don't get out there and show your thing, you know, how are you going to get out there? It's kind of a catch-22. There are some unscrupulous toy companies. The well-known ones that you see in the toy store, by and large, are pretty honorable. And I've actually been in situations where I showed a toy company a concept, and the guy said, oh, so-and-so showed me something similar a couple of years ago, but it didn't have this feature on it that I had. And I would have to cut her in on the royalties if I took your item. And I thought, wow, that's pretty honorable. You know, I thought that was pretty cool.
It is.
So, not to say they're all honorable. It's a tough business. It's, in spite of the fact that it's all about play, you know, it's still, everybody's trying to claw to the top and have the next big hit.
Yeah, well, you're mentioning the submission form. If you're lucky enough to get a toy contract or game contract, what should you look for in that contract?
I thought you might ask that. Well, obviously, it's great if you could secure an advance. And almost everybody does give you an advance. That is a non-refundable advance against royalties. The more they give you, the more invested they are in you. And if it comes down to it, when the decision time is being made, whether to go with your idea or someone to whom they paid a smaller advance, they would pick you because they're more invested in you. So certainly I'd say the number one item you want to make sure you have is a non-refundable advance against royalties. The industry norm for percentages is between 4 to 6% of the wholesale price. The wholesale price is usually roughly half of the retail price. So if a game sells for $20, the wholesale price is $10. Your royalty would be 5% of that. Also understand, if they say, well, we're going to do a Sesame Disney version of it, that those entertainment licensors are going to take a piece of your royalty. So now you, instead of 5, you may be getting 2.5. Understand that, and you don't fight it, but, you know, obviously anytime that's mentioned, you do your best to negotiate the biggest percentage you can for yourself. You also want to build in milestones. If the company now has ownership of your concept for the length of the contract, you want to make sure that they're not going to just sit there and do nothing with it. You want to build in milestones like first shipment date and agreement for what might cause you to terminate the contract. Like, for instance, if you don't have X number of sales by a certain time, or you don't launch at Toy Fair 2011, you can terminate the contract. So you build in termination, you build in milestones and agreements for terminations. They also have things, and everybody's dream is to invent a game that there'll be, you know, lunchboxes and dolls and all kinds of stuff. Maybe an electronic version, a video version, a TV show, game show, and, you know, all the things that come from your game. You want to make sure you get a part of, and you have to be careful about those deals because there are certain rules of thumb for it. What those are called, sublicense deals. That would be, you know, the licensed property that would come from your game, and maybe perhaps other game companies that might license the one you're licensing to sell it abroad, for instance, a Dutch game company or a British game company. You know, so there are all these details, and you want to make sure that you don't, what if the game, you know, what if the little gizmo that you invented that shoots the ball pops apart and hits somebody in the eye? You want to make sure that you are protected against those kinds of happenings. So you have an indemnity clause protecting you from problems. And that may sound silly if you've got a card game, but I have a story about a game that I did several years ago. I won't say the brand. I probably shouldn't, but it was a well-known entertainment license on the game, And it was supposed to come out for Christmas a couple of years ago. And the company packaged it in this really cute vinyl zip case. And a disreputable testing company said that the game flunked testing, safety testing. This is a card game, mind you. And would... And then all the media went crazy and said, you know, if a product contains this chemical, it can sometimes cause death. And this reputable testing company had, the only way you could cause death, it was to eat the vinyl case. But this was like a month before Christmas, and it was all over the media, you know, XYZ card game, you know, flunks safety test, you know, and then death, you know, illness, seizures, you know, all this crazy stuff. And, you know, these kinds of things happen. You could get, you know, absolutely, you know, this is a card game. I couldn't believe it. I don't recall if I had an indemnity clause in that contract, but I certainly have one in every contract I've done since then. And, of course, the test results were ultimately refuted. After Christmas.
It's all the time.
After the big sales period.
Right.
Well, really, those things happen.
Yeah, it really sounds like it's smart for somebody that comes up with a game to get an agent. How can our listeners get in touch with you?
Well, with me? Oh, my goodness. My website is GameBird, game like the game you play, bird like the bird that tweets, .biz, B-I-Z.
Okay, that sounds good.
And I welcome, and I kind of specialize in newbie inventors. I have been able to put some brand new inventors' products on the market, so I really do welcome new inventors and would love to hear from anybody who's got that game on the shelf that they've been thinking about trying to sell and, you know, want to move forward with.
Okay, that sounds super. Well, thanks for being on the show today, Mary. Our listeners have really gotten some great nuggets and learnings that they can use in their launch of their game or toy and the journey that follows.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I enjoy talking with you both.
Okay. Well, it's been another great show, Lee.
Yes, it has.
And tune in each week at the same time to listen live or to go to our website at thelaunchhour.businessradiox.com to listen at your convenience.
But first, a special thanks to today's sponsor, Patents & More, your trusted guide through the innovation jungle.
And until next week, I'm Ron Reardon with our producer, Lee Cantor, signing off another great session of Launch.